Hi, good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. Welcome to the City of Hayward Housing Workshops. My name is Diana Gomez, and I am a housing program specialist with the City of Hayward. And joining me today, I have my colleague, Angie Watson from Echo Housing, and she will be sharing information about the federal and state fair housing laws and rights. As we know, many of our communities have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, and with so much information and resources out there, sometimes it can be difficult to navigate and to access. And so this is why we're bringing these workshops to you and hoping that you can access these resources and find them helpful at this time. Angie, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to you now.
Great. Thank you, Diana. Hello, everybody. I'm Angie Watson, hi Jim, and I am the Fair Housing Coordinator here at Echo Housing. And as Diana said, I'm going to be giving an overview of federal and state fair housing laws. I'll talk a little bit about some of the common issues that come up in fair housing, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the cases that we get into our office and things that come to our attention. And I know for many of you, this might be very new information. So people are welcome to ask questions. We'll take questions after the webinar. I'm happy to answer any issues that come up around fair housing and make sure that you go away with some, hopefully some really good knowledge. Those of you who are not familiar with Echo Housing, I want to kind of give you a little bit of background about who we are. We are a nonprofit counseling agency, and we are actually one of the oldest fair housing agencies in the country. We got our start back in the early 1960s. Some folks came together back then to fight against discrimination in housing. They were able to get money to open up an office. Our first office was opened up in Castro Valley, California. And now 56 years later, we now have six offices. So we have our main office in Hayward, where I work out of normally, working from home now. But our main office is in Hayward. We have an office in Oakland, in Antioch, Livermore, and two offices in Monterey County. And we do much more than just fair housing work. We also have a number of other programs too at Echo Housing. So we have a landlord-tenant program, and that's a program that helps tenants and landlords know what their rights and responsibilities are. So we might have a landlord that calls us and they'll say, you know, I have this tenant who is causing a nuisance. This tenant is, you know, destroying the property, harassing other tenants, not paying the rent. And so they want to find out what their rights are around that issue. And so we provide knowledge, information to that landlord. Likewise, we'll have tenants that call us about issues regarding repairs. You know, my landlord's not fixing my broken heater. You know, my oven doesn't work, or my landlord's coming to my home without proper notice, or my landlord's harassing me. So we help both parties. We give impartial information to both about what their rights and responsibilities are. We also have a program that helps people when we have funding. It helps people with their back rent, or helps people who are trying to access housing and need help with their deposit. So we have that program right now for the cities of Livermore and Pleasanton. And from time to time, we do get other funding for other areas. Right now, those are the two areas that we currently have funding for, Livermore and for Pleasanton. We also have a wonderful home buyer program. So anyone out there who's looking to become a first-time home buyer, you're welcome to sign up to take our classes. We have wonderful people that come in and they do a great job in really helping people understand what steps that you have to take in order for you to become a homeowner. And so it's a really great program for folks who want to, you know, to buy property and learning how to do that. So we have a lot of different things that happen at Echo Housing, but really fair housing is really the backbone of our agency. And so my job as a fair housing coordinator is really broken up into three parts. So a huge part of my job is investigating complaints of discrimination. So people will call my office if they feel that they have been denied housing, they've been treated unfairly in housing, they're being harassed in housing because of their protected class. We'll talk about what those classes are throughout the call tonight. So people can call my office, they can talk to a counselor, it can lodge a complaint. And so my job and my colleagues who work in fair housing, our job is to find out, is there evidence of discrimination really going on? Because when we get a call that comes into our office, we don't know the full story. So we have to do an objective investigation and find out, is there evidence? Because if we get a complaint that comes in and there's no evidence to support the allegation, that complaint doesn't really go very far. So our investigations take on many different looks. So we might call up the property owner or the manager, oftentimes we will, that you know has the complaint lodged against him or her to find out what their side of the story is. We will sometimes talk to other tenants, former tenants. We do testing. So it's no secret that fair housing groups like Echo Housing do testing where we send out trained people who pose as home seekers and we have them go out and get information about what's going on at the property. And sometimes we're able to uncover discrimination by doing that. So we will sometimes do that as part of our investigation. We also, it's really important for us to educate our owners and managers and everyone in the community. So a big part of our job outside of investigating complaints is that we talk to owners and managers and tenants and nonprofits and community-based organizations and anyone out there that wants to learn about fair housing. We're always happy to go out and give a training for free about fair housing laws and what you can and cannot do. And for those of you, especially who are owners, who are managers, who are housing providers, it's so critical that you know about fair housing because this is your industry and it's important to know what the rules are. Because if you get caught in a complaint of discrimination, you can't just say, oh, I didn't know. Ignorance is no excuse. So we really encourage our owners and managers out there who provide housing to come to Echo Housing. Let us train you. We're happy to do this so you know what your rights are, but also what your responsibilities are in providing housing. The other piece of work that we do is we provide mediation. So I'm a certified mediator, and there are times when issues come up, fair housing issues that come up, where mediation is something that both parties want to take part in. So I do a lot of information and a lot of mediations around things like children in housing. A lot of times there's unique issues that come up in housing children. And so I will sometimes bring in the owner, the manager, the tenant, the family, and try to mediate different issues that come up around children. I also do a lot of mediations around disability. So people who are asking for reasonable modifications or accommodations, do a lot of mediations around that as well. So those are three big parts of what I do in my job, you know, providing investigations, providing mediations, and also doing this, you know, talking to people about fair housing laws. And I want to just say too that, you know, most of the calls that we get in are from tenants, but we really love it also when our housing providers, our owners call us too. You're able to access our services just as our tenants are. So just want to make sure that everyone knows that it's not just a tenant-based organization. We really do try to help both parties. And I want to just say one last thing before we go into the presentation, that Echo Housing provides fair housing for all of Alameda County, except for Fremont. So Fremont has your own fair housing agency. We also do fair housing for the whole area of Contra Costa County, except for Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh also has their own fair housing agency, and we do fair housing for all of Monterey County. So we're pretty well spread out. And we are, like I said, you know, right Hayward-based, and so a lot of our work is done here in the city of Hayward. So Diana, can you go for it with the next slide?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that introduction, Amy. Let me go ahead and share my screen to start the presentation. Okay.
Okay, so let's go to page 4. Okay, great. So what is fair housing? So fair housing simply is the right that everyone has to live in any type of housing they want to, free from discrimination. When I talk to my owners and my managers, I always say, you know, irregardless of how a person looks or how they dress, their lifestyle, how they wear their hair, you know, how they speak, as long as they can pay your rent, you know, as long as they're going to be a good tenant, take care of your property, be along with the other neighbors, you got to give them a chance to live there. You don't want to use illegal barriers to keep people from accessing housing. They can pay your rent. They got the good credit. They got the good rental history. You got to give them a chance to live there at the property. So that's basically fair housing, equal access to housing. That's one of the big missions of Echo Housing for the past 50 years, making sure that people don't have illegal barriers up against them when they're trying to access housing. Okay, next slide. So we're going to talk about the federal fair housing law. So these are laws that are not just in place here in California, but all across the country. So, you know, wherever you go around this country, whatever state that you go to, that state is going to have these fair housing protections. And those protections are race, color, religion, national origin, sex, disability, and familial status. So you cannot be denied housing or treated unfairly in housing, harassed in housing, because of your membership in one of these classes. And I want to say about sex that is also interpreted to cover sexual harassment that is also illegal. We've had a few sexual harassment cases that come through our office. It doesn't happen very often we see it, but I know we had a really egregious case down Monterey County last year it was, where a man was a tenant and he had filed a fair housing complaint based on sexual harassment that was being done to him by his female property manager. So it was the first case that we've ever had where a man was calling about sexual harassment in housing. I also had a case several years ago in Alameda where I had a woman who called and she was being sexually harassed by her female manager. So you can have sexual harassment between, you know, a same sex situation, or it could be a man, you know, complaining about a woman in housing or vice versa. But however it goes, you know, sex is covered. Sexual harassment is a violation of fair housing law. So next slide. So I want to talk a little bit about disability, because probably about, I'm going to say a good 60% of my cases deal with disability. It's a huge issue in fair housing. And when I go out and talk to my owners, my property managers about fair housing, I always say, treat everyone the same. Be consistent, be consistent, be consistent. I always say that. However, if someone is disabled, you have to treat them differently in housing. You sometimes have to allow that person who is disabled to have a reasonable accommodation. And so the classic example of a reasonable accommodation would be, let's say you have a no pet policy. You don't allow pets on your property. That's fine. You don't have to. Pets are not protected. However, if someone comes to you, they're disabled and they have a emotional support animal or a service animal, you have to change that policy. You have to allow them to have a reasonable accommodation, allow them to have their emotional support animal or their service animal. You also can't charge that person who's disabled any pet rent or pet deposit, any kind of pet fees for that animal, because that animal is not a pet. It's an assisted animal. So the law looks at that animal differently. You also can have breed restrictions. I know I oftentimes will see ads on Craigslist, for example, where people say, you know, we allow pets, but no German Shepherds or no Rottweilers or no pit bulls. When it comes to emotional support animals, when it comes to service animals, you can't have a breed restriction. However, I will say, if you have a bad reference about an animal, let's say you do a rental history background check on your applicant, and you find out that the dog that belongs to that disabled applicant caused a lot of problems on the property that where he used to live. Maybe he bit other people or other animals. Maybe the dog was a real nuisance. You can use the fact that an animal was aggressive or had exhibited dangerous or bad behavior. You can use that with evidence. You can use that to say, I'm sorry, I won't allow your dog to live here. Outside of that, you would have to allow that person who is disabled to have their animal, even though it's a restricted breed that you normally would not allow on your property. You also can have a weight restrictions. You can't say, oh, I'll allow you to have your animal, but it can't be more than 25 pounds, or it can't be more than 50 pounds. You wouldn't be able to do that. So people who have disabilities, they have these special animals, they have a lot of freedoms to have the animals that they want and that they need to help them. And I wanna just say there's a difference between emotional support animals and service animals. So emotional support animals are usually given to people or prescribed to people who may be suffering from a bipolar condition, or they may be suffering from depression. They have some kind of emotional psychological disability, and that animal provides support to them, provides them the ability to, you know, to just feel better, to not have the depression or have the bipolar condition exacerbated. A lot of times pets really do a lot of really great things for our mental and emotional health. Emotional support animals often will do that. Service animals are a little bit different. So they are usually animals that are trained. For example, I had a woman in Alameda that she had epilepsy, and she had an animal, a little dog. He was an adorable little dog. And that dog was trained so that when she was about to have an epileptic episode, the dog would bark. So everyone around her would know that she was about to have this, you know, seizure. So it was a very, you know, well-trained animal. And service animals usually are trained. People who are blind, you see people who, you know, have guide dogs, people who may be hearing impaired, they may have a dog to help them. So service animals are trained animals that do particular service for that person who is disabled. Also, there's other things that come up around accommodations, such as allowing a caregiver. Someone may have a disability where they need help. They need someone to come in and provide care for them, or they need someone to live with them. They need 24-hour caregiving. So as the owner, as a manager, if you have a person who is disabled and they need a caregiver, you have to allow them to have the caregiver. Now, the caregiver is not going to be your tenant, so you wouldn't treat the caregiver as you would treat your tenant. So you wouldn't have to give the caregiver, you know, a key to a laundry room or extra key to the apartment. The caregiver is really just the employee of your tenant who happens to be disabled, happens to need a caregiver that lives with them. So caregivers are not going to be people that you're going to, you know, you're not going to do a background check on them or, you know, have them fill out an application because they're just really there to help the person who is disabled. Now, I will say that caregivers have to abide by the rules, though, of the property. So if you have a caregiver that lives with one of your tenants and caregiver is causing a nuisance, you know, fighting with other neighbors, you know, violating different lease rules and policies that you have, you can deal with that bad behavior. You don't have to allow a caregiver to break your rules, or they have to, you know, act as they would living there as a tenant and making sure they're following all the different lease rules that you have in place. But you would need to allow a person, if they need a caregiver, you have to allow them to have that. You also sometimes might be required to have a person who is disabled be allowed to break their lease. I had a case a couple of years ago where a woman, she had signed a one-year lease to rent a townhouse in Union City. And things were fine for the first couple of months, but she had this, she had some problems with her back. And she had the problems before she moved into the townhouse, but it got progressively worse. And it got to be to the point where she could no longer go up and down the steps of her townhouse. And even though she had just you know, sign this 1-year lease, and she had only been like 2 months in the lease. She couldn't live in that apartment. She couldn't live in the townhome anymore. She couldn't go upstairs. So she asked the owner if she could break the lease. And the owner said, well, no, you can't. You just signed this lease a year, just for, you know, for a whole year, just been a couple of months. You can't break the lease. So this woman called Echo Housing. We took her complaint and we were able to mediate between the disabled tenant and the landlady to help her get out of the lease without penalty, because she simply couldn't live there in her apartment in the townhouse. She couldn't function there. So she was able to get out of her lease because she was someone who was disabled. Parking spaces. So there are times when someone is disabled and they need a closer parking space. And I know for a lot of landlords, for a lot of managers, parking is like, it's like the one of the big issues that come up that are sometimes very, very difficult to resolve, because oftentimes parking is very limited. You have very limited parking. You have more cars and more people in parking. But you would need to try to work with someone if they're disabled and they need a closer parking space. You might want to put them on a list. And so when a closer parking space comes up, they can have it. So basically, you know, what you want to remember as a property owner, as a property manager, that when someone comes to you who is disabled and they need an accommodation, you want to work with them. You want to open up a dialogue. You want to try to see if you can work with them. And a lot of times Echo Housing, we could be a partner in that conversation. We can help you have a conversation with your tenant, help you mediate what the tenant needs and also what your needs are too and what your property needs are. So just keep that in mind. When people are asking for accommodations, it has to be reasonable, but you really do want to try to work with them and help them get their accommodation request granted, because oftentimes they really need that dog or that closer parking space. You want to help facilitate that to the best of your ability. And then call Echo, you know, if you need some help with that. So next slide, Diana. So we'll talk about reasonable modifications. So accommodations deal with, you know, changing rules, changing policies. Modification is a little bit different. So that deals with situations where someone who is disabled needs to have some kind of physical change in their home. So it could mean that person who is disabled, they need grab bars in the bathroom. Perhaps they use a wheelchair, or they walk with you know, crutches, or they walk with, you know, with the walker, and they need to have a ramp built so they can go in and out of their home. Or perhaps they have a hearing impairment, so they ask to have a special light that goes off when someone rings their doorbell. They need to have the carpets pulled. I had a case years ago where a woman had severe allergies and she couldn't have carpet in her apartment. So she asked that the manager remove the carpet so she could live there. So sometimes people who are disabled need to make these modifications. Now, the question that I often get is, who pays for the modification? Who pays for that? So what we have to find out is who owns the property, because that's going to tell us who pays for the modification. So if it is a private landlord, then the tenant pays for the modification. If it's a landlord that is a landlord that gets public monies that come to his or her property, or it may be a HUD property. HUD is a federal fair housing agency. They also provide and manage thousands and thousands of public housing spaces in the country. So if it's a building that HUD owns or manages, or you know, city monies go into that building, oftentimes the owner would pay for the modification. So that's how we determine who would pay for it. So oftentimes the tenant has to pay for it, but I know there are certain cities at certain periods in their life that get funding to help people pay for modifications. So if you need to, you know, get help with the modification, you can certainly call me and I could try to help you access funding if you're a tenant to get funding for that. There used to be some programs, I know at Alameda, there's a program that helped landlords that need to make modification. I don't know if that program is still available, but there are some funding sources out there for both tenants and landlords when it comes to modification. So yeah, next slide. So I'm gonna talk about verification. So you know, as a landlord, as a property manager, that if someone is disabled and they need an accommodation, you have to work with them and try to give them that accommodation. But you also have the right to make sure that person really is disabled and really needs that accommodation. You have a right to ask for verification. Oftentimes that comes in the form of a letter from a doctor or a therapist or a psychiatrist or a licensed social worker. So many different people can write letters for people who are disabled that can state the person is disabled and needs this particular accommodation. So you have a right to ask for that. You have a right to say, well, sure, Angie, you can come live on my property with your animal, but I need verification that you really do need this animal. And so I would have to go back to my, you know, health professional, get a letter, and submit that to you. Now, if a person has a disability that is obvious, I mean, they're blind, they're in a wheelchair, you of course would not ask for a verification. But if a disability is something that's hidden and someone's claiming that they are disabled, you absolutely have a right to ask that that person provide you with verification that they're disabled and they need to have this reasonable accommodation. That's absolutely your right as a property owner and manager to ask for that. So next slide. Okay, so we'll go on to the next slide from there. So we're gonna talk about children. So I mentioned that probably about 60% of my caseload deals with accommodations and people who need them. But I also get a lot of questions about children. And since 1988, it has been illegal for a property owner, a property manager to deny someone housing because that family had children. And most owners and managers know they can't say no children. But what I see in housing that happens quite often is that even though an owner or a manager may allow a family of children to move into onto the property, they oftentimes have policies that are illegal for those children that live there. And so one of these policies is one that we still see quite a lot in housing is called steering. And steering happens when an owner, manager, they have a property and they have one part of the property set aside for families that have children and the other part of the property for people that don't have children. So my first right working at Echo Housing a zillion years ago, one of the first cases that I worked on was a steering case. And in that situation, what was going on was an owner who had a pretty large property, unincorporated San Leandro. He told his manager that he only wanted families with kids to live in the back of the apartment. He didn't want to see kids in the front. So if you were someone looking to rent, you know, an apartment in this apartment complex, if you had children, you were steered to the back of the apartment, the back end apartments. If you were someone that was single or you had a family without children, you were offered an apartment in the front of the building. So this manager was practicing segregation. So she was putting all people with kids in one area and all people that were single in another area. And what we found out was that there's a real difference with how the property was maintained. So in the back of the building, you had the gravel, you had the trash cans. It was not very well maintained at all. In the front of the apartment, you had, you know, the shrubbery was nice. They had flowers. It was cleaned up. So there's a real difference with how the maintenance people were taking care of the property. And so what happened was we started getting phone calls, my coworker and I, that people who were living there were complaining, saying, you know, we're all here, all of us that have children, we're all living in the back of the building here. And we never see kids in the front of the building. We never see kids that live in the front units. And so they had some concerns about that. They felt like something was not right, you know? And so we had some, you know, complaints that came into our office. And I mentioned earlier that a lot of fair housing groups like Echo, we do testing. And so in this case, we set up some tests. I think we had like 3 tests that we did. And in this case, we sent out testers that had a profile of having children and testers that had a profile of being single. And we had these testers go out to the apartment after making an appointment and tour the units and talk to the manager, ask questions, do a report. And what we found was the testers that had children, they were in the back. They were only shown the back units. The testers that were single were shown the front apartments. So we have evidence then at that point that there was discrimination going on. There was steering going on at this apartment. So we went back to the folks that made the complaint to ask them, you know, what they wanted to do. And they wanted to sue. They wanted to file a lawsuit against the owner. So we helped the tenants get an attorney, Chris Brancard, one of the most talented fair housing attorneys in the country. He took on the case and he won. It was a settled case. But it's really important to know that as a property owner and manager, that you don't have the right to steer people to one part of the property. You have to allow people to decide where they want to live. Now, sometimes you might think, well, you know, it's easier for all the kids to be together. They can play together. The parents can watch each other's kids. Or you might think, well, it's not safe to have a kid living on a second floor because he could fall down. There's steps, there's a balcony. It isn't your decision to decide where people live. So if you have a family and they got a couple of toddlers, they want to live on a 18th floor of your building and they, you know, qualified to live there, you have to allow them to live there. It really is their choice, and it's their responsibility to make sure their children are going to be safe. It's not up to you to decide that. So you want to make sure you don't do any steering. You just open up your property to everyone and anyone, you know, they qualify, you want to offer them the apartment. Sometimes managers have different rules and policies around children that are illegal. So I always tell my managers and my property owners is that when you have rules, and you can have a lot of different rules. I mean, you're really free to make whatever rules you want to on your property, but you want to make sure that those rules are applied equally to both children and to adults. I had a case, it's kind of a funny case, several years ago. There was a woman in Hayward, on-site manager, and she had in her rules that all children had to be in by dusk. That was in her rule, and that was in her house rules. So in the winter time, it gets, you know, dark around, you know, 5:30. And at that time, she wanted all the kids to be in their homes, and they had to just be inside. They couldn't be outside, had to be in. So of course, you know, parents that had kids didn't like that rule, and they called Echo Housing, and then they called me, and I talked to the parent, and I said, well, you know, she can't have a rule like that that singles out children. So I called up the manager, and I explained to her that she couldn't do that. Now, if she wanted to have a rule that said all residents must be in by dusk, must be in by 5:30 or by 6:30 or whatever, she could do that. It would be a crazy rule. People would probably, you know, leave her apartment. She probably get a lot of 30-day notices. But because she singled out children, that was the part that was discriminatory. You can't have rules that single out children. So if you have rules that say things like children can't skateboard, or children can't ride their bike, or teenagers can't loiter, that's illegal. You need to put residents can't loiter, residents can't ride their bike, residents can't skateboard. So you want to have rules that are applied to everyone, to not single out children. You also want to make sure that, especially if you have like a rec room or a gym room, you don't have rules that say kids can't be in the rec room or kids can't be in the gym. You can have some safety rules around that. So if you have a gym on your property, you can say, you can post a sign that says children under 14 must have an adult with them, because in a gym, you're going to have, you know, equipment that's going to be heavy. It could be dangerous for children. So you could, you know, for safety reasons, say that kids can, you know, have a, they can be there, but they need to have an adult with them. That's fine. Or there's a recreation room or a laundry room. You want to make sure you don't have areas or off limits to kids, because kids live there too. They have a right to use, you know, the amenities there on the property grounds. Now, if you have a pool, same thing. You can have a policy that says children under 14 must have an adult with them at the pool. That's actually under the Health and Safety Code of California. So you're allowed, and you should actually have that posted, because kids under 14, you know, for safety reasons, should not be, you know, in a pool without an adult with them, without having a supervision. So that's fine for you to say that. What you can't do is you can't have a pool and say, well, from 10 to 12 is going to be kids hour, and then from 12 to 2 is going to be adult hours to swim. You can't have pool hours for kids. I know a lot of HOAs, a lot of homeowner associations, I've seen this, they'll have a pool and they'll say, you know, kids can use the pool from this time, adults use a pool from that time. And that's illegal. You have to have a pool open and accessible to all people of all ages at all times that the pool is open. So you can't have those kind of separate pool hours for kids and adults. You also want to be very careful around supervision, around restrictive rules around kids being able to play outside. I see this happening a lot, especially in the summertime when kids are home from school, they're outside, they're playing, and managers might have a policy that says, you know, if your kids are outside playing, you got to be out there watching them. They have to have an adult with them. That is looked at as being overly restrictive. So if you have a child on your property that's causing a nuisance problem, that's throwing rocks at people's, you know, car windows, that's, you know, trampling the, you know, on the grass, or, you know, destroying the flowers, whatever, you can always deal with bad behavior. But you don't want to have policies that say things like adults must be outside with their children while their kids are outside, because the courts have looked at that as being overly restrictive. So you want to make sure that you allow kids to play, and they can play by themselves, as long as they're behaving. A lot of, you know, parents feel comfortable with their children of a certain age, you know, playing outside without having their, you know, caregiver or their babysitter outside. So you want to be very careful about supervision. Like I say, if a child is causing problems on the property, causing a nuisance, you deal with that problem. You know, you talk to that child's guardian, their caregiver, the babysitter, the parent, deal with that behavior, but you don't want to have these blanket policies about kids having to have adult supervision when the kids are playing outside. I also want to talk about surcharges. Now, we don't see this happening very often in housing, but I know years ago, it was very common for property owners and managers to ask for a higher deposit for families that had children. And they did this because they figured, well, kids are going to add more wear and tear on the property, so we're going to get a higher deposit. That is illegal. You cannot do that, of course. Most people know that. You can't charge a higher deposit because a family has children. Also, likewise, if a person is disabled, you can't charge them a higher deposit because they're disabled. I had a case several years back, where there was a property manager who was going to increase the deposit on a woman who was going to be moving into his apartment because she used a wheelchair. He was concerned that the wheelchair was going to cause marks in the carpet. He wanted to, you know, add extra money on her deposit. And that is illegal. He could have a regular deposit as he would for anyone else, but, you know, he wasn't allowed to charge this person who is disabled a higher deposit because of her disability. And likewise, when it comes to children, of course, you don't want to charge a family more rent or more deposit because they have kids. That would be illegal. One thing that I want to talk about briefly, it's not on this slide, is not a federal law, it's not even a state law, but it is a guidance, and it's called 2+1. I want to talk a little bit about that. So, because there's been some changes around that. So it used to be when I would do my workshops and my you know, presentations with owners and managers, I would always say, you know, you should go by the 2+1 occupancy guideline. And that guideline was implemented by the Department of Fair Employment and Housing several years ago. This agency oversees fair housing for the state of California. And they have this policy guideline where they, you know, encouraged and they actually wanted property managers, owners to go by this 2+1 guideline, which meant that for every bedroom, the manager owner should allow 2 people per bedroom plus 1 extra person for the whole household. So if a manager owner had a 1-bedroom apartment that they were renting out, they should allow at least 3 people, 2 people in a bedroom plus 1 extra person. So it could be, you know, 2 adults and a child, or 1 adult and 2 children, didn't matter. So it was a guideline. And so for many years, you know, I would tell my owners and managers to go by this 2+1 guideline because it allows families with children to have access to housing. Now, things have changed a little bit. It's kind of, you know, nebulous right now about where this department wants to go on this. There was a lawsuit, a case that was filed against a property management company down in Bakersfield, California, where they were doing the right thing. They were doing what people like me tell them to do, you know, go by the 2+1 occupancy guideline. But there was a case of a large family, I think it was a family of 12, that was trying to access housing. And the property management said, well, you're beyond our occupancy guideline. You can't live here. I'm sorry. But his family went through Department of Fair Employment Housing. And they filed a fair housing complaint with this agency. An agency, you know, did an investigation. And they told this property management company that their 2+1 occupancy guideline was not sufficient because it didn't allow enough access to housing to people that have large families. So this property management company, even though they were going by 2+1, they were dinged because the 2+1 occupancy guideline was too restrictive and it wasn't going to allow a large family to live there. And, you know, a lot of times when you have large families, you know, it's going to be very hard to find a large, you know, affordable place for them to live. You know, how many 3-bedroom homes are out there that are going to be affordable to you know, a large family in the Bay Area. So I would say to you, anyone who manages property, owns property, that you definitely at least want to go by 2+1. That is it's a safe harbor, but there may be times when you have to expand that 2+1. You have to actually allow more people than 2+1 would normally allow. So, you know, depending on the size of the home, the square footage, configurations of the bedrooms, there's different things that go involved, that are involved with that. So 2+1, we've always, you know, kind of put that out there as the guideline for all of you folks to follow. You should, but you may have to sometimes increase that. So if issues come up around occupancy guidelines with your applicants or with your current tenants that live there, you want to call Echo Housing. Let us kind of help you walk through that with you. Okay, so next slide, I believe. So next slide I'm going to talk about is about criminal records history. So I want to just kind of give a little background about this. Back in 2012, when President Obama was the president, he told HUD, which is the Federal Fair Housing Agency, oversees fair housing for the whole country, he told HUD to enact policies that would make it easier for people coming out of the criminal justice system to get housed. Because what fair housing advocates were saying was that when people had a criminal record, they were not able to get housing. They were totally just sometimes locked out of housing. There was a case that got quite a lot of attention a few years ago, this African-American man down in Louisiana. And he had spent some time in prison. He had committed a crime back when he was in his 20s. He was now in his early 50s. And that criminal history was following him around. Every time he would go to try to access housing, everyone say no to him because he had this felony. Now, he had been out of prison for many, many years. He had even had a job. His employer loved him. He didn't have any issues with the criminal justice system since he got out. He was a good standing resident in the community, but he had this record. He had this this criminal record, and it was preventing him from getting housing. And what happened was he had to end up moving in with his elderly mother, who lived in a mobile home park, because no one in his parish in Louisiana would rent to him. So we started hearing more and more stories about men like this African-American man who couldn't find housing because he had this criminal record. So President Obama at that time wanted to make it easier for people to get housing. And so we have this criminal records history guideline. And what we want owners and managers to do is that when you're looking at a person, you're doing your vetting, you're doing your tenant screening, you're doing your criminal background checks, you can still do that. That may be changed. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. You can do your criminal background checks, but you want to look at what the nature of the crime was and how long ago was that crime. So in the example that I just gave, the African-American man down in Louisiana, he had been out of prison for like 20 years, a long time. So someone has a felony and it's, 20 years ago that they did this crime, or even 7 years ago, you may not be able to count that against that person and, not allow them to access housing. Now, if someone just got a, Santa Rita jail, he'd been there for, a year, he had beat up his girlfriend, just got out of jail, you could probably use that as a, legitimate reason to not allow that person to rent on your property, because it was, a crime that caused physical harm, and it was a very recent crime. So you want to just be very careful and not just have this blanket policy where we don't allow anyone on our property that has a criminal history, because you're going to be in violation of this guideline. Also, California Department for Employment and Housing recently, they also have enacted guidelines around criminal history as well. So you have the federal guidelines, you have the state guidelines. Now, I want to just say to you, because I just said that, most of you out there can, still ask for criminal history, but that may be changing. There is an organization in Oakland called Just Cities, and they're a social justice organization. They've been doing work in California to make it to where housing providers cannot ask about criminal record history on the application. This group has been successful in the cities of Oakland and Berkeley in disallowing owners to ask that question on the application. So if you are an owner, property manager, and you have your property in the city of Oakland or the city of Berkeley, you cannot even ask that on your application if a person has a criminal record history. Now, you still can for the rest of California, but this organization called Just Cities, they are trying to make it to where it's going to be a ban on the whole country, so no property owner can ask that question. So we'll see how successful they are in the future. But right now, I just want to say, definitely be flexible around criminal records history. And if you have questions about that, that's a question that you could certainly pose with Echo Housing, and we can kind of help you come up with some policies that are fair to you and, the people who rent from you, and, applicants are coming in as possible tenants. So you want to make sure that those guidelines are not going to be too restrictive and cause people who, have gone through the criminal history, criminal justice system, you don't want to prevent them from getting the housing that they oftentimes so desperately need. So next slide. So we're going to talk about California law. So California, our wonderful state of California, we have some additional protections under California state law. So for example, we have marital status. So I want to just tell you a little bit about how that law came to be. It's kind of a funny story. So about 20 years ago, more than that now, a young couple were out looking to find a place to live. they have been dating a while, and they wanted to move in together. So they went out and started searching for housing. And what happened was they found a place that they both loved and they could afford it. And they met the landlady, and everyone liked each other. Everything was going fine. Everything was going good. Then the landlady asked the couple if they were married. And the couple said, no, we're not. And the landlady said, well, you know, I'm a Christian, and it goes against my, you know, religious beliefs to have people living on my property without the benefit of being married. You're a nice couple, but I'm sorry, I can't rent to you. So this young couple, they were shocked and they were upset. And they sued this landlady for discrimination based on marital status. We didn't have that as a protected class, but they sued her on the basis of that. So it went to court, and the lower court ruled in favor of the couple. The judge said that this woman didn't have a right to deny this couple housing. Then the landlady's attorney appealed the case. It went to the appellate court in California. And the appellate court had a whole different take on it. The appellate court said, well, wait a minute, this woman has some sincere beliefs around religion and what's right and what's wrong. She shouldn't have to have those beliefs just trampled on by allowing this, you know, couple to live on her property. She had every right to say no. That was the appellate court. Then it went to the Supreme Court of California, which is the highest court in the state of California. And finally, back in the year 2000, the Supreme Court came down with their decision. And what they said was that it would be illegal for any person to deny someone housing based on their marital status. So this young couple, they made this law. And also what this law did too, is that it used to be an owner could say, if you're a married couple, you can combine your income to meet the income guideline. But if you're two roommates, you have to make that income guideline separately. And so this law, this marital status law, it changed that. So now, as many owners and managers know, you have to combine everyone's income, anyone 18 and over, whether they're married or just roommates or, you know, whatever the configuration is of that household, you got to combine all that money together. But before this marital status protection, you didn't have to do that. So that's what happened with that law. All sorts of income is protected. So you cannot say things like, you must be employed to live here in my property. That would be illegal, because many people have different ways of bringing money into their households. So someone could be on Social Security, they could be on disability, they could be on CalWORKs, the welfare program here in California. They could be getting alimony or child support. So people have all kinds of ways they have money that they use to pay their rent. As long as that money is legal and you can verify it, you have to accept it. So you can't discriminate against someone based on the kind of income that they make. So that's covered. Ancestry is similar to national origin, where your family originates from. That will be covered under California law as it is under federal law. Sexual orientation is, of course, covered. So you don't want to deny someone housing or treat them unfairly in housing because of who they love, who they are. That would be illegal under California law. Gender identity is also protected. This is a newer protection, actually. So example might be a man who was born a man, but feels as if he's a woman. That's his identity. His gender identity is of a female. So if you have someone in that situation, they have a right to live on the property free from harassment, free from threats. So gender identity is also covered. I know there's been some talk recently with the Biden administration of making gender identity also a class that would be protected under federal law as well. Right now, it's only protected under California law. Genetic information. So this is also a new protection as well. And that has to do with, example would be, let's say someone was born a female and they had a sex change, now they're a man. and the manager owner found out about it. And for whatever reasons, he doesn't like that and thinks it's wrong and it's against his religion or his beliefs and starts harassing the person or give that person notice to vacate, that would be illegal. So genetic information is also covered. Like I said, that's the newer protection under the state California law. Citizenship also covered. So you're not able to ask a person about the citizenship as an owner, as a manager, also immigration. So, you know, someone may be undocumented. I always tell my owners and managers that, you know, your role is not to be the role of ICE. That's not your role. You're there to provide housing. So you cannot deny someone housing because of immigration status or, of course, you know, harass them. What we see a lot of times, especially in the city of Hayward, we have a lot of Spanish-speaking residents that live in Hayward, and we have a fair amount that are undocumented. And a lot of times they're very fearful about calling Echo Housing for help because of threats they get from their owner, the manager. Like, you know, if you call Echo Housing or if you call for help or if you complain, I'm going to call ICE. And that is egregious and it's wrong and it's illegal. And so, you know, you don't want to do that. It's against the law to do that. Anyone has a right to file for housing complaint or call the city of Hayward for help or any other entity in regards to their citizenship, immigration status. Gender expression is also covered. So you might have a tenant who is a male who's very effeminate. And so he expresses himself as a woman or, you know, just someone who's very feminine. So, you know, however people express themselves, you know, that's their life. That's them. You know, shouldn't affect your treatment of them as your tenant. Also, military and veteran status is also protected. Now, you would think, you know, most times people really love veterans and people who serve in the military. They have a lot of accolades that come their way. A lot of times we're very proud and we're very grateful for people who serve in our military who are veterans, but not everyone feels that way. So you might have someone who's, you know, anti-government or anti-military or, you know, anti-war. They don't want people who are in the military or who are veterans to live on their property. That would be illegal under state law. You couldn't treat a veteran or a military personnel person differently than you would anybody else. Primary language, also a very new protection. There was a case just maybe a couple of years ago, not long ago, where a man had, he had an apartment, he managed, an apartment down LA area, and most of his residents were Spanish speakers, and they would speak Spanish. It would be in a laundry room, or they'd be outside speaking Spanish in their native language. And he had a policy where he would not allow them to speak Spanish. He told them, this is America and you have to speak English. I don't want to hear Spanish. So he tried to enact this policy. It sounds crazy, but he tried to enact this policy where people who were speaking the native language could not speak that language. So owners and managers, you know, they can't dictate the language that people speak. You have to allow people to speak the language that they feel comfortable with. You can't have a policy of, you know, changing that or telling people they have to speak English. So that is also protected, primary language. Section 8. So many of you probably know by now that Section 8 is a protected class. As of January of 2020, Governor Newsom signed the law that made Section 8 a protected category. So it used to be that you could say to Section 8 applicant, sorry, you know, I don't want to participate in this program, no Section 8. You would have been within your rights to do that. But now you can't do that. You have to take people who have Section 8. Now you can absolutely make sure that they qualify to live there. You can check their rental history, make sure that, you know, they don't have evictions, make sure they have decent credit. You can still do that. But if they qualify based on your criteria and they have Section 8, you have to rent to them. Also, one thing I want to say too is that many times an owner and manager will have a policy that says you must make three times the amount of the rent. That's very common I hear. 2.5 times, 3 times the amount of the rent. Very common that I hear. Now, when someone is on Section 8, you're going to look at their portion of the rent. You're not going to look at the rent itself to determine how much income that they're going to have. You're going to look at what is their portion of the rent that they're going to be paying. So for example, let's say someone's going to rent an apartment from you, and Section 8 is going to be paying, you know, most of their rent. And their portion of the rent is $200 a month. That's what they have to pay. That's their portion. You could say to that person, you have to pay 3 times the amount of your rent. So in this case, it would be $200. So they would have to make $600 a month to make your guideline. So that's just an example. So you want to look at the Section 8 person's, their portion of rent that they're going to be paying, and then tell that person they must make 2.5, 3 times the amount, whatever it is for your property. They have to make that amount in order to live there. So it's something that some owners and managers have some confusion about. Also, under California law, we have what we call arbitrary discrimination. And it has to do with everything else I didn't talk about. So, you know, someone has got green hairs, or you don't like teachers, you don't want to rent a teacher, so you don't allow teachers to live on your property, you don't allow students to live on your property, you don't want people who are too young or too old, or you don't want people that, you know, are professional dancers or whatever on your property. So that would be discrimination based on what we call the Unruh Act. And it deals with all the other kind of ways you could discriminate against people. It's illegal. You just can't discriminate against people regardless of their, you know, race, and also things like their age. I see sometimes some bias around young men when they are trying to access house. They don't see it a lot, but I have seen it. I think some owners and managers think that young men, I'm talking about, you know, a young man who's 20 years old, for example, or 21, early 20s, that they're gonna be irresponsible, they're not gonna pay their rent on time, they're gonna trash the property. So sometimes I think I've seen that. I've had, you know, complaints of younger men who call Echo Housing for help, feeling like they were being, you know, treated differently or being discouraged from renting because of their other age and their gender. So I want to just tell owners and managers that young people can be very good tenants. A lot of young men out there who are very responsible and could pay their rent and do pay their rent and could be great people there on your property. And also, I sometimes see a bias, not a lot, I have though, against older residents. Usually these are residents that maybe have been living there on the property for a while, and the manager will call me and say, you know, I'm really worried about Mrs. Johnson. You know, she's 88 years old, she lives by herself, and I don't think it's really safe for her to live there. I'm concerned about her. You know, should we give her a notice to move? But I was like, no, of course not. As long as Mrs. Johnson can pay her rent and take care of her, you know, apartment and all of that. So I think sometimes managers get really protective over older residents that live on their property because they're fearful that they're going to hurt themselves. I would say if you have a situation, we have an older person on the property and you're concerned about them, that you let them know, you know, check in with them. Are you okay? Is there someone I can, you know, call to, you know, maybe have that older person have a number on file of maybe a child or a grandchild or a good friend or someone from their church or synagogue that it could be called on if that person gets in trouble or is having problems living there. We don't want to assume that people, because they're very old or very young, they can't live there on the property. So that's a bias that does come up. I want to just say before we go to the next slide about occupation, there was a really interesting case back in 2014, I believe, where this man was trying to buy a home. So the fair housing laws cover not just rental housing, but also covers a home buying process too. So if you're trying to buy a home or try to get a loan or get insurance, you have protections against discrimination in that process. And so there was a younger man and his wife, and they had one child on the way. They had a toddler in hand, and they were trying to buy their first home. They went to his open house. I think it was like in Modesto, California, somewhere in Central California. And they were wanting to, you know, look for a new home. They went to this big development and they wanted to put a bid on a house that they both liked. And they did that. And the developer of the housing division told this man that he would not sell the house to him because he was an attorney, he was a lawyer. And the developer just felt like, you know, attorneys are too difficult and I don't want to deal with them, keep your money. So what ended up happening was this person, this lawyer who was trying to buy a home for his family, his growing family, he sued the developer for discrimination based on his occupation. And he won. And that's why we got occupation on here as well, because you cannot deny someone housing, whether it's buying a home or renting a home, because they're a lawyer, because they're a police officer, because they're a teacher, because they're an exotic dancer, whatever. You can't do that under California law. So just want to share that with you. Okay, next slide, Diana. Okay, licensed childcare. So As a property owner, as a property manager, you are free to say that your tenants are not allowed to run a business in their home, that home they rent is for them to live there, for their family to live there, not to have a business run out of the home. So you can't have, you know, you don't allow someone to, you know, do taxes or, you know, do hair or, you know, sell cookies from their home. You have a policy that does not allow that. And that's fine. But if someone is a licensed daycare provider, that's an exemption, you have to allow them to run their daycare in their home on the property. Now, the operative word is licensed. So you have to, as a, you know, a person running a business, a childcare business, you must be licensed in order to have this protection. So if you are a property owner and manager, someone comes to you and let's say they're a tenant that already lives there or one that's trying to move in and they are going to be doing licensed, you know, that childcare, you have to allow them to do that. You also cannot force them, mandate that they have insurance. Now, most childcare providers that I've worked with, Record Housing, do have insurance. I think when you're working with children, it's probably, you know, very wise to, you know, have insurance. So most licensed daycare providers do have insurance, but they don't have to. What the law says is that the childcare provider can submit one of three things. So they can have insurance, they could be bonded, or third thing, they could have a letter that's written by all the parents that have kids there in the daycare saying that, you know, we understand that our child care provider doesn't have insurance and we're okay with that. So you could get all the parents to sign off on a letter, have it notarized and all that. But you would not be able to force that daycare provider to have insurance. You also cannot charge higher rent to that person who's doing the childcare. You can charge a higher deposit, as long as the deposit is not two times the amount of the rent for an unfurnished apartment. So you can charge a higher deposit than you would for your other tenants. You can do that for your licensed daycare providers who are living there on your property. You're able to do that. Now, the daycare could be a daycare that's run from like, you know, 8 to 5. It could be 24-hour daycare. So you wouldn't be able to stipulate what the hours are of operation of that childcare. You would have a right to expect that the person running the daycare is abiding by all the rules, that they're making sure the kids are safe, that the kids aren't, you know, disturbing the neighbors, the parents that pick up the kids aren't parking in other people's parking spaces. So you know, definitely have the right to make sure that the person running the daycare is abiding by the rules of the property, is being a good neighbor to everyone. But you would need to allow that person, if they're licensed, to be able to run that daycare in their home. That's the only exemption under the law regarding business. So thank you, Diana. Next slide. So next slide, I usually go over this when I'm doing my workshops with people who are looking for housing. So I tell home seekers that, you know, as they're looking for, you know, an apartment to rent, just know that the owners and managers that they, you know, meet, that they talk to, can ask for certain things. They can ask for bank statements. They can ask for good rental history. So landlords oftentimes will, you know, call and get references and see how a person was living, you know, at their previous home. Owners can certainly ask that applicant provide verification of their income. That owner can ask that money be put down so a credit check can be done, or that manager could ask that they be able to do personal reference checks. Now, when it comes to credit checks, I just want to say that if you take money from someone to run a credit check and they get denied, you have to give them a copy of their credit report. They ask for it. If they pay for it, they get denied, they want a copy, you need to provide a copy of the credit report for them. So these are just things that tenants, you know, we teach them that they need to be aware of when they're trying to seek rental housing. Thank you, Diana. Next slide. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about advertising. Advertising is also protected under the Fair Housing Law. And when a person, an owner has a property, you know, for rent, they're going to advertise it usually. They want to get it rented out. I know a lot of housing providers use Craigslist to post their properties. It's a very popular site platform that people use. So you want to make sure that when you are writing your advertising, that you're not using discriminatory language. So you don't want to have things like professional or working people preferred. You don't want to have preferences. You don't want to put things like professional, because what if someone is not professional? Maybe they, you know, they're a bus driver, they're a plumber. They don't have a professional white collar job. That means they wouldn't be able to live there on your property. So you don't want to have those kind of words like that in your advertising. You don't want to have advertisements that say, you know, not suitable for children. Now you may think your property is not suitable for kids. Maybe there's, you know, it's up on a hill. Maybe, you know, it's, you know, it has terrain that you feel is not safe for kids. But you don't put that in your ad. You don't use that as a way to discriminate against people that have children. So don't ever put in your ad, no kids, unless you have a property that's a senior property. So seniors who are 62 years of age or older, or 55 plus housing, you can deny children in most situations from living there. But all other housing outside of senior housing, you know, suitable for kids as well. Also perfect for young single adults. So once again, you know, what about older people or people who are married or domestic partners? So you don't want to have those kind of words in your advertisement. You don't want to have things that say male preferred or female preferred. Now you are able to do that. There is exemption to this if you are a person, an owner, and you have one room in your home you're renting out, you can do a same-sex preference. So you can be a woman that has one room in her home she's renting out, making a little extra money. She could put in her ad on Craigslist, female preferred. Or if it's a man and he lives in the home and he has one room and he's renting out, he can say male prefers. You could do same-sex preference. You can't have be a man and then say, you know, prefer a female or vice versa. You wouldn't be able to do that. Also, you don't want to have things in your ad that say we're a Christian community or a Muslim community or Jewish community. Of course, that would be illegal because it's a community for all kinds of people on all kinds of religions and so forth should be, you know, welcome there at your property. Must be employed. So we know that source of income is protected. So sometimes people, especially now, a lot of folks are out of work. A lot of folks are getting unemployment. That's the way they pay their rent. That's how they're going to be living for a while. So they may not be employed. They may still be a great tenant. They may have, you know, the income that you want them to have. They may have great, you know, rental history. They may have good, you know, credit history. You got to let them live there. So you don't want to have advertisement that says must be employed. No Section 8, You don't want to see that on your ad because that would be illegal, because Section A is now a protected class now. Great for college students. I know, you know, Berkeley has UC Berkeley campus there. A lot of students live there. And sometimes, you know, owners will put in the ad, great for college students, but that's illegal because not everyone that lives near the UC Berkeley campus is a student. It could be, you know, people that are not students that need housing. So you don't want to put that kind of advertising in your ad. And of course, you don't want to put, you know, not suitable for wheelchairs, because even though you may think a person in wheelchair, it wouldn't be a great fit for them, or it wouldn't be suitable for them. Once again, that's not your decision to make. It really is up to that applicant to decide if this apartment, if this home is going to be suitable. So you want to make sure you kind of get the bias out of your mind and just open up the housing, show it to everyone. So I would just say with advertisement, if you have questions, I know I get some providers that will call me, housing providers, owners, managers will call me. They'll ask me to read their ad, make sure there's nothing on there that's discriminatory. And so I'm happy to do that. If you're having questions about how to put your ad together, what language you can use and what language you can't use. Also on this, it's not on the slide, that should be on the slide. We don't want you to have advertisement that says no felons, because we want to make sure that, you know, people who have felonies also have access to housing, depending on what that felony was and how long ago that felony happened. So you don't want to have an ad that says no felons as well. So this is just some list of just some, you know, words and things that you want to avoid. Basically, in a nutshell, you want to just talk about your property, you know, 2-bedroom apartment, balcony, large kitchen, you know, near, you know, Lake Chabot, whatever. Talk about the property and the neighborhood, but not about the kind of people that you want to attract to your property. So just be very careful, because this does, you know, come up sometimes in housing, this advertising stuff that comes up quite often. So be careful about the words that you use. So thank you, Diana. Next slide. Okay, so this is my 9 magic magnificent management tips. So over the years, I've talked to many owners and managers, of course, you know, around different things that come up in fair housing. And I came up with these 9 tips that managers can use. I think that if you do, I think you'll be in pretty good shape. So we'll talk about them now. First thing, you want to let applicants know your criteria. So if you want people to make 2.5 times the amount of the rent, you need them to have a credit score of 720. You need to have them not have any eviction for the past 5 years. Let people know what your qualifications are, because that's going to save them time and energy. You don't want people applying on, you know, to live on your property and you know they don't qualify based on what they're saying to you. So just let people know, put it in writing. This is what we look for, you know, so they know, oh, I had an eviction just a couple of years ago, or my credit score is, you know, 550. I'm not going to apply there. I'm not going to put my money down for that place. So let folks know, let applicants know what your criteria is, what you're looking for. Have a good non-discriminatory answer to the question, what kind of people live here? So this happens quite often, you know, when you're doing a tour and you're showing the property around to an applicant, a prospective tenant, and that tenant, prospective tenant might ask the question, what kind of people live here? You know, kind of innocently, or maybe not so innocently, they may ask that question, and you don't want to engage with them on that question. You want to just say something like, you know, all kinds of people live here. You know, you don't want to say, oh, we have a lot of, you know, young families. We have a lot of, you know, immigrants that live here. We have a lot of older people. Don't even get into that conversation. Let them figure out who lives in your property. Let them come back, you know, on the weekends or after hours to look and see who's on the property. But you don't want to engage people into this topic of what kinds of people live in your property, because hopefully all kinds of folks live in your property from all different backgrounds live there on your property. You want to let people know why they are being denied. So if someone doesn't meet your qualifications, they get denied, let them know, because if you don't let them know, Sometimes those folks may think that they were denied for something that was, you know, based on some kind of discrimination because of their race, because of their religion, because they have a disability. So if someone doesn't meet your criteria, they don't qualify to live there, just let them know that. Let them know what their issue was, and why you could not rent to them. It helps them feel better to know that. Put all your rules in writing, very important. Now, some managers will just say things verbally to their tenants about different rules and so forth. You know, it's fine to say things verbally about your rules, but also put them in writing and make sure that your tenants have a copy of the rules and have them sign a copy of the rules, and you keep a copy, they keep a copy. So people are very clear about the rules. There's no you know, situation where a person could say, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that was the rule. I didn't know I couldn't have, you know, guests come to my home and stay for a whole month. I didn't know I, you know, couldn't do that. So I would say just, you know, put everything in writing. Also, I would say have a good open door policy. You know, a lot of times we get calls, myself and my coworkers, where people are calling our office. And it isn't about discrimination that's really the problem. A lot of times is they feel that their manager is not respectful to them, you know, doesn't respond to their concerns, doesn't answer their emails or their phone calls. So I would say really try to have open door policy, really try to have good communication with the people that you're renting to, because they're paying money to live on your property. And in this area, they're probably paying a lot of money to live on your property. So you wanna make sure that you treat them respectfully. You wanna make sure that you let them know that they can come to you when there's issues, when there's problems. People want you to talk to them. Make sure they know how to get a hold of you or someone that is your agent that's working for you. Because a lot of times people call because they're just angry because they feel like they're being ignored and they feel like they're just not being respected on the property. So, you know, try to work with that. And we have a tenant landlord department that deals with mediations between landlords and tenants when they aren't getting along. So if that situation comes up, you know, we can be a mediator. But I have one property owner who has lots of properties in Hayward and Southern Alameda County. And he'll often call me up and he'll say like, Angie, you know, I'm going to need your help here. We got a problem that's, you know, stemming, you know, between my manager and my tenant. And so he gets right in, he's very proactive because he wants to keep the communication good between his management staff and tenants. And so the things start going kind of haywire, he jumps in there, gets in front of it, gets Echo Housing involved, helps us, you know, help him to work out the problem. So, but really, if you just, if your tenants know that you've got their back and you're there to be a good landlord and take care of the property, you're probably going to have, you know, pretty good tenants. They're going to appreciate that. And so that, you know, respect goes definitely both ways. Keep good documentation. So make sure that if you do have a problem with the tenant, you know, they're breaking the rules, you know, they're causing a nuisance, they're not paying the rent, whatever's going on, documenting, have a file. Because if someone calls my office and they say, oh, you know, this owner at, you know, this apartment is harassing me because I'm a, you know, single woman, or because I'm a single mom, and I call you, and because this person has made this, you know, allegation, and I call you, you might say, well, no, I'm not harassing her because she's a single mom or a single female. I'm giving her notices because she's breaking the rules there, because she had, you know, a bunch of parties over the last several weekends and the cops had to be called, or she's fighting with her neighbors. And that's why we're telling her she has to move out or giving her notice about her behavior. So you want to be able to defend yourself. So if I get a, you know, if I call you or HUD calls you or DFEH calls you, Department for Employment and Housing, their staff calls you about a complaint, you want to be able to have that documentation that you didn't do anything wrong. You weren't harassing this person. This person's had lots of problems that you've experienced. and you have that documentation to back it up. So be really good about that. It'll come in very handy if you ever have a complaint lodged against you or a lawsuit. You might have that good documentation. Treat everyone the same, you know, just really, you know, we're all humans and we have our favorites. So we have our biases and all that. That's natural and all that. And but you want to make sure that you treat people the same. You may have a different rapport with a certain tenant. You may get along better with a certain family. You may like someone more than you do another tenant. Like I said, it's natural, it happens, but you still want to treat everyone the same. You want to do your best to treat everyone, give everyone the same level of service, because that's going to help you go a long ways if you do that. Keep getting educated. So if you are an owner, a property manager, a leasing agent, you know, you're a nonprofit and you're providing housing, so critical that you know about fair housing law, that you know what you can and cannot do. And the laws change. And, you know, there's just, you know, new laws that are being enacted, you know, under fair housing law, under tenant landlord laws. You want to keep up to date about the new laws, because agent list is not going to save you. You can't say, oh, I didn't know that I, you know, had to take Section 8 clients or tenants. I didn't know that. Well, that's no excuse. You have to know. You have to know what these laws are. You have to abide by them. And so keep getting educated. As I said earlier, Echo Housing does a lot of education and community to you know, anyone who wants it. So, you know, definitely, you know, give us a call. And then also get help when needed. Like I was mentioning, the one property owner that calls Echo Housing when things come up on his property. You know, call us. We're here to provide counseling, education, mediation to you as well. So definitely use our service as you need to. Next slide. So I think this is, and I think this is the last slide here. And this is a list of all of my my coworkers. I'm Angie Watson. Hi, Jim, at the top there. That's my my email and phone number. So, you know, definitely, as I said, you know, reach out to Echo Housing. If you have questions, you can go to our website, www.echofairhousing.org. That's www.echofairhousing.org. And you can go on our website and find all of the different, you know, different services that we offer, our contact information, and definitely feel free to reach out to us. So hope this information was useful. Hope it was valuable to you, and it's been a joy to be here. So that's it. that's all, folks.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that valuable information. I do see that we have a couple of participants. Just wanted to open up the floor. If anybody has any questions, you can go ahead and raise your hand now and I can allow you to speak.
Great. So
let's open it up for some questions. And then in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and share your contact information again, Angie, so that we have it on the chat.
Okay, perfect.
So there is your contact. And before we go, I just want to remind everybody, Angie will be back with us next week to talk more about fair housing rights. We have another workshop coming up tomorrow as well. We have a Spanish workshop. We will be going about our City of Hayward rental assistance program and also how to navigate our website. And again, that workshop will be in Spanish. Angie will be back on the 24th to talk about fair housing rights at 6 p.m. I don't see any questions in the chat. So again, Angie, I just really want to thank you for bringing this wonderful resources and information. We really appreciate you for joining us tonight. And also, if anybody has any questions or if you would like to follow up with us directly, please feel free to give us a call or send us an email. Let me go ahead and share just real quick. Also, the information for the workshops, I'm adding it on the chat. So you can go ahead and reach out to us. And then the second information that I am going to be adding is for our contact information at the Housing Division. We are working remotely, but we are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 5. So with that, we come to the end of this presentation. Again, Angie, thank you very much. Thank you all for joining us tonight, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Diane. It's been a pleasure. Take care. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you as well. Bye-bye.